In February 1970, Jeffrey McDonald called the police for help, and when officers arrived at his house, they discovered the murdered bodies of his pregnant wife and two young daughters. Miss McDonald was arrested and later convicted of the crime. In his latest book, A Wilderness of Error, Errol Morris argues that the details of the case were tragically obscured by bias, speculation, and error on the part of nearly everyone involved. Mr. Morris is the Academy Award-winning director of The Fog of War. His other films include The Thin Blue Line and Tabloid. A Wilderness of Error is published by Penguin, and I'm very pleased to welcome Errol Morris back to our show. Hello.
Thank you for having me here. I've missed you.
We've mostly talked about your films in the past, and one of them, The Thin Blue Line, was in large part responsible for the release of Randall Dale Adams, who'd also been convicted of murder. This book reads almost like a treatment for a film. Did you think about making a documentary about this case?
I thought of making a feature film about the case because...
With actors?
Yeah. Yeah, with actors.
That would have been a departure for you.
Well, I'm planning to do that in the near future anyway, so I need a number of departures, or at least an opportunity to redefine what I do.
Well, you've done reenactments, which is kind of like what you do in a feature film, isn't it?
I guess. I mean, that's a crazy discussion on its own, reenactments and what are they and what do they do. But yes, I guess that's the simple answer. Yes, I have done them.
And you thought about making this into a film, but you ran into all sorts of roadblocks?
There's a really massive roadblock in filmmaking. No one gives you the money to make the film. When you're a writer, you can just go up to your garret apartment and start writing on a pad of paper. The options available to a filmmaker are somewhat more limited.
And what's the problem with getting financing for a film like this, that people believe that he's guilty and it would be a waste of money to make a film that might suggest otherwise, or do they just feel this case is too old?
I would say all of the above.
But people remember the McDonald case in the way that they don't remember an awful lot of other murders. They remember it almost in the same way they remember the O.J. case.
Certainly it was a case that got an enormous amount of attention. Not so much at the time, but at the time of the trial, which is in 1979, and subsequent to the trial in... a best-selling book, Fatal Vision, in a massively watched episode of 60 Minutes, and then later in a TV movie starring Carl Malden and Eva Marie Saint. Mm-hmm. Tens of millions of people were exposed to this case, but I would argue to a false narrative.
And others have also argued that. Janet Malcolm wrote a serious critique against Fatal Vision. It's been a subject of debate almost from the start. Is that one of the reasons it took so long between the time of the murders and the trial to actually take place? It was years, wasn't it? 9 years or something.
9 years between the murders and his eventual conviction in federal court.
When did you begin to suspect that McDonald might not have been the killer?
I was certainly aware of this case in the early 90s. I had just finished The Thin Blue Line. I wasn't so sure I wanted to become involved in another case like that.
You became became the detective who turns up all of the real evidence and proves that somebody was falsely convicted. That could be a career.
Well, I called myself a new kind of hyphenate, the director detective, because I actually wasn't making a movie about a murder case. I was investigating a murder case while making a movie. Mm-hmm. Here, what really fascinated me about the case is that everybody seemed to know about it, but they knew about one version, that version that had been presented by the prosecutors in federal court in 1979, and I felt that there was something deeply wrong with that story.
So what was that story, and what did you think was wrong with it? He was a Green Beret doctor.
Yes.
Was he somebody who people liked?
Yes. He had gone to Princeton, Northwestern Medical School, Green Beret, doctor in the Army, Captain Jeffrey McDonald, lovely wife who was pregnant with their third child, two baby daughters. There was nothing in his history to suggest that he was capable of killing his family, and yet that is what he was accused of, and that is what he was convicted of in 1979.
What about his in-laws? Weren't they convinced that he was guilty?
Well, a lot of people became convinced
that
he was guilty.
But was that because they had always disliked him, or did they just come to suspect him because of the circumstances?
They came to suspect him.
There was a good deal of psychiatric evidence in the trial and investigation. How many psychiatrists evaluated?
There was no psychiatric evidence in the trial, oddly enough. This is a story, of course, of many, many, many trials and hearings. He was brought up on an Article 32 shortly after the murders. He was still an Army officer. And in the military, they have to make a decision whether or not to proceed to a full court-martial. And so they hold this hearing, Article 32. At the end of the hearing, the presiding magistrate said, there's no case here. The case is not true, and Jeffrey was released and subsequently left the military. As a civilian, the Army continued to pursue him, and then the FBI and the Justice Department.
Well, to some degree, it was the circumstances of the case. He claimed that drug-crazed hippies chanting things like acid is groovy and kill the pigs had committed the murders, and that sounded totally fabricated.
Today, it seems ludicrous. Of course, the murders were in February of 1970, just months after Charlie Manson and members of his family were arrested for a series of truly brutal murders in California.
So this could have been a copycat murder?
Well, here's what was argued. Jeffrey McDonald made an emergency call early this morning. The MPs arrive at the house. He tells them a story about four intruders, a hippie girl, an African-American male, two white men who had broken into the house and had killed his family.
And where was he at the time?
He had also been stabbed and beaten, but his injuries were in no way comparable to what his family had suffered. Almost immediately, the MPs and the Criminal Investigation Division of the Army came to suspect McDonald.
Well, isn't that usually the case? You usually suspect the husband in a case like this.
Clearly, this must have happened to you.
No, just I've read that in most murders, it turns out that the murderer is somebody who knew the victims.
Yes.
And so the police automatically look at the boyfriend, the husband, the wife.
Absolutely. But here is the weird twist in this case. They came to believe that he had staged the crime scene, that he had made the crime scene look like the Manson killings. He had used it as a blueprint for his own excuse to deflect suspicion from himself. So why am I obsessed with this story? And I am truly obsessed with it. I think everybody listening today is familiar with false narratives about how a story can be put out and believed by almost everybody and still be untrue and still be false. So the book that I've written is really a book about how a false narrative gets traction, how it grabs a hold of us and won't let go, even despite the fact the evidence may weigh to the contrary.
Do you think that part of that was a result of the political climate at the time? We're talking about the Vietnam War becoming...
Height of the Vietnam War, 1970.
Becoming less popular with the public. And here's this guy as a green beret. They almost are the stereotypical soldiers of the Vietnam War. Could this be an anti-Vietnam War story as well?
Certainly Vietnam figures into it. There are legends of all of the drugs that came in from Southeast Asia through Fort Bragg, body bags filled with heroin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's part of the story. I don't know if I know exactly how it all fits together.
My guest is Errol Morris, who's an Academy Award-winning director of The Fog of War. His other films include Standard Operating Procedure, Mr. Death, Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, A Brief History of Time, The Thin Blue Line, most recently Tabloid. He's also the author of Believing is Seeing, Observations on the Mysteries of Photography. His book is published by the Penguin Press. It's called A Wilderness of Error, The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Errol Morris, whose latest project is a book, A Wilderness of Error, The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald. It's published by the Penguin Press. And you talked about the narrative that we all learned, the narrative created by Joe McGinnis's book, Fatal Vision?
By the prosecutors, by some of the military investigators, by Joe McGinnis.
And he depicted him as a sociopath.
Diet pill crazed sociopathic killer.
So the diet pills were responsible for driving him crazy?
Not just driving him crazy, for turning him into a killer.
And McDonald sued McGinnis. What happened with that lawsuit?
It ended with a kind of hung jury, but there was a settlement, and McDonald was paid damages.
You go through the details of the investigation pretty carefully. What did the house look like when the investigators arrived?
This was a crime scene thoroughly trashed by the investigators. People were wandering through the crime scene. Evidence was contaminated, lost.
Did they look for fingerprints?
They looked for fingerprints, but in many instances they destroyed many of the fingerprints which were left in the house.
And why did they do that? I mean, you talk about military police moving through the house in wet boots. This is nothing like what I see on television when they're doing an investigation on CSI.
The investigation, to be generous, was incompetent. The crime scene was not preserved. One thing that we forget about, and this is true of history as well as criminal investigation, evidence is perishable. If you don't collect it, it's not just going to hang around and wait for you to come after it 10, 20 years hence. Evidence can be damaged, corrupted. This is a story also about how the belief in Jeffrey McDonald's guilt cause people to ignore evidence that should have been collected.
He was accused of wiping his own fingerprints off the telephone. Why would he even do that? It was his telephone.
There are all kinds of stories about his motivation, but ultimately, and this is something that I truly believe, there ain't no motivation to be found here. It does not make sense.
Mm-hmm. There were important pieces of physical evidence that came up during the trial. Could you talk about his pajama top and the flower pot? The coffee table?
I'm fascinated by details. You might call it an obsessive fascination with details. I read one recent review of this book, which called me a dog with a bone, and I would happily admit to that. So what I've tried to do in A Wilderness of Error is turn the reader into an investigator. Not an investigator in some broad, meaningless sense, but give them the details and force them to work out on it, whether it's an overturned flower pot or it's a coffee table that landed in a way that it perhaps shouldn't have, or it's a pajama top with puncture holes. And on and on and on, take these 30 or 40 details, think about them, and tell me what you think.
Now, a listener named Kevin called in and said to say that he was at Fort Bragg with McDonald and heard instantly on the night of the murder that McDonald was guilty. So there was a rush to judgment there.
Absolutely.
Now, once you have established that everybody thinks he's guilty, then this is not a matter of proving that someone is guilty. This is a matter of proving someone's innocent.
Well, presumably in our justice system,
we're presumed innocent until proven guilty.
I've heard that expression. but it's not always the case. It doesn't always work out that way. One of the remarkable things about this story is that if you really believe he's guilty, then maybe you don't look for certain kinds of evidence. You don't look for those evidence which would suggest that he's innocent.
Well, then you also reject possible leads. For example, a woman named Helena Stokely became an important figure at the trial.
Yes.
Now, who was she?
Well, here is that account that no one really believed, the account that there was this hippie girl.
And a man named Ken Micah is also, you interview in the book, he talks about having seen a woman who matched McDonald's description.
Well, here are the quote-unquote coincidences. One of the MPs on his way to the crime scene, answering this emergency call from McDonald, saw a woman on the road near the McDonald house. Couldn't stop. He's on his way to answer an emergency call. He gets to the house. McDonald describes the four intruders, one of whom immediately he connects with that woman that he saw. Tells his commanding officer, no one goes to pick her up. No one does anything. But wait a second. The following day, a hippie girl in Fayetteville, who was a narcotics informant for the Fayetteville police, start saying things suggesting that she was in the house that night. And she repeated those things again and again and again and again over a decade.
And was ignored all the time? Because people do confess to crimes that they have not committed.
I haven't confessed anything today, but it's possible.
Well, in your case, you've been a suspect for many years, but that's a whole other matter. There are people who do confess to crimes, and they often know a lot about a case because they've read about it in the newspaper, seen photographs.
Too many coincidences here for me. Not only did she confess, but others confessed as well.
So why didn't his lawyer bring her to the stand?
He did bring her to the stand in 1979, and on the stand she could hardly remember anything about that night, even though within days of that testimony she had confessed once again to a whole variety of people. One of the questions is, if she was confessing to everybody, why didn't she confess on the stand in federal court? And it wasn't until over 15 years later, 20 years later, that there was an answer to that question. A federal marshal, James Britt, came forward and said he had heard one of the prosecutors threaten her if she took the stand and said she had been in the house that night.
Threatened her with
prosecution for first-degree murder.
But she was admitting to being a participant in first-degree murder.
But not on the stand in federal court.
What about his lawyer, Bernard Siegel? You spoke to him, didn't you?
I did indeed.
He has died recently.
Yes.
Is somebody taking up the case?
Oh, he's had so many lawyers over the years. A friend of mine was his appellate attorney for years, Harvey Silverglade.
Now, he also claims he asked, or claimed he asked for forensic evidence several times. We have seen a number of cases that have been overturned because of DNA evidence. Why would the prosecutors be reluctant to provide?
The prosecutors have played a very strange game here. Prosecutors have a job to do, but that job should never involve suppressing evidence or framing a person. It should be, on some level, fair, and this was not.
It seems that a lot of people who have come forward at later dates to change their stories in this case.
This won't be the first miscarriage of justice story in America, no.
Well, you begin your book by talking about how a story gets created. You were kind of hinting at it earlier. Why do you think people are so drawn to the idea that Jeffrey McDonald did murder his family?
Often we believe things because of a rush to judgment, because it's easier to believe one thing versus another, because there's a kind of herd mentality. A snowball starts rolling downhill, gathering momentum. There are lots and lots and lots of reasons, but
don't we also have a desire for a coherent narrative? This is something you would understand as a
absolutely.
Filmmaker.
One of the things that we hate, it's probably programmed into our DNA, we hate ambiguity. We like closure. One of the things that has fascinated me about this story in particular, there are two kinds of murder cases for me, speaking as an investigator and as a writer and filmmaker. There are cases that have closure. When I did The Thin Blue Line, yes, this guy was convicted and sentenced to death for a crime he didn't commit. But I was able to investigate it, and in the end, the real killer confessed to me. It's at the end of my movie. And I know, with some level of certainty, high level of certainty, that guy who told me he didn't do it was telling me the truth. Closure, a feeling that the case has resolved itself and I can give you answers, basic answers to questions. But there are other cases. Take the Kennedy assassination. How many years are we into that? Close to 50 now. Will there be another 100 books, some claiming that there was a lone gunman and some claiming that there was a conspiracy? Yes, there will be. Will there ever be closure? Maybe, maybe not.
On Martin Luther King's assassination as well?
Martin Luther King's assassination. What is it about these kinds of cases that resist resolution? And one of the things that A Wilderness of Error tries to do is to provide an answer to that question. Why it's so difficult in this case to come to a definitive answer.
Did Helen Stokely name the other people involved?
She did indeed.
And have they been followed up on?
Some of them have been, and at least in two instances have suggested that they were in the house that night.
And despite all of that, there's reluctance to even reopen the case? McDonald has been in jail since 1979.
Since he was convicted in 79, released, and then incarcerated in 81, 82, yes. Long time. We're talking 30 years. Lots and lots of reasons why it has gone on and on and on. Part of them is that no one has ever looked at the totality of the evidence.
And you opened the book by describing your first encounter with the house in which the murders took place. You've put the floor plan on the cover. What is it about this house that you find so interesting?
Well, in some deep sense, I believe, that the answer is in that floor plan. It's in that evidence in that home. Some of it, of course, is lost. A lot of it is lost.
Is the house still standing?
No, it's all gone. Gone.
It looked like it was a nice house, but I guess nobody would have wanted to have moved in after what happened.
People did move in, and then eventually it was destroyed.
So, Jeffrey McDonald, is people are working still to reopen the case?
There's a big hearing in Wilmington, North Carolina, at the end of this month, where for the very first time since 1979, the totality of the evidence is going to be put before a federal judge.
Hasn't the Innocence Project gotten involved?
They indeed have. They are part of this hearing.
So do you think that new DNA evidence will finally be presented?
New DNA evidence will be presented. It's part of the case. But we have this idea that DNA will provide a magical solution to all crime. This crime, of course, involves a man who lived in the house. His DNA is everywhere. What becomes significant is not so much his DNA as the DNA of people who cannot be sourced to that house.
Of course, as you point out, that was also partly damaged by the muddy boots and all the other things that were tracked into the house during the initial investigation.
Yes.
So we won't know whether it was a police, an MP who provided that DNA, or Jeffrey McDonald, or a killer.
It is possible that DNA could resolve this case, but it's not as simple as it may sound.
Errol Morris's latest project is a book called A Wilderness of Error, The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald. It is published by the Penguin Press. And it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. I hope the next time you come by, we'll be talking about this fascinating film project that I know you're involved with. I don't want to reveal it now, but I look forward to seeing you then.